CJAM 99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CJAM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, Jeff Thiessen will be giving us some insight into the latest issue of Thrive magazine. So what can you tell me about the latest work with Thrive?
Well, Cam, we were typically a three-time-a-year publication, which is a bit of an awkward number. So we added, in 2024, a fourth issue, which is a resource guide. And you know, we took a bit of a different approach, and that it's not listings of different, you know, prosthetic componentry, like types of feet, hands, elbows, sockets. There's a little bit of that in there, but it's more about peer support, self-care, you know, point of view. So as much about the physical aspects of being an amputee, but the emotional and the social pathways that we need to follow to live well with limb loss, as we say with Thrive magazine.
So, what are some of the key benefits of sharing the wealth of how to cope with an amputation on a mental health level, or having resources available? What are some of the benefits for the amputee community?
Well, I think, you know, the way we packaged it, so there's a lot of information on different topics and subjects that we may be going through. And we're all at different ages and stages of life, of acceptance, of the journey of being, you know, someone with limb loss. So, you know, we can't just be painted with one broad brush. Some information is, you know, stuff that we've dealt with already. So, you know, at least within the covers of this publication, there would be something for everyone at really any stage of life, age-wise, but stage two of amputation. And it's, you know, peer support is so important, an appropriate peer support, finding somebody with true commonalities, not just the fact that we're both missing a limb, but the same interests, same philosophies, and yeah, we really spent a lot of time in the publication laying out the importance of that, which there are organizations that provide that. Sometimes not always easy to find. We think, you know, the World Wide Web is at our fingertips, but sometimes it's hard finding that authentic information that can really relate and be relevant to us as amputees.
So I'd imagine some of the stories and solutions offered are from lived experience, offering a practical approach from someone who's been there.
Yeah, and absolutely every case. I think there were 10 different sections, and each began with personal, authentic stories and how people are managing their lives with, you know, a variation of limb loss. But most of the content really comes from our community, as we really wanted to hang our hat on that, like you said, the authenticity and peer-to-peer approach.
So Do you find that switching over and having more additions and having the resource guide available is something that's practical, something you're going to stick with Thrive?
We are. Does it matter too much on the subscription front from a financial standpoint? Not a lot. We added that in as part of the subscription. But fortunately, our advertisers were very supportive of the idea, and in particular, the idea of a resource guide that has shelf life for well throughout 2025 until we make another one at the end of this year. So, yeah, and I don't want to call it a greatest hits of Thrive, but we really did go back through 27 issues, previous issues of the magazine, to pull some of that really relevant or pertinent content that would fit in a resource guide.
So, what are the next steps forward in creating the next one?
The next issue itself or the next resource guide?
The next issue, as the resource guide, I'd imagine, is a ways off, as you mentioned.
Yeah, it would be. And we would, sticking with the resource guide for a moment, we're already thinking, well, what does that one look like? And we'll probably take a bit of a different approach with it. We're not sure what that is just yet. But yeah, back to business as usual with our next issue, which will come out in March, and back to the regular format of, a cover story, a profile or feature of someone who, an amputee or living with limb loss or limb difference, as the vernacular of the day is. Content on healthy residual limbs, healthy mind and body, new prosthetic releases or advancements. So just keeping people in the know of what their choices are for them.
So in an ideal world, what would be a story you'd love to cover in terms of an amputee who's actually thriving with limb loss and making a difference in the amputee community?
Yeah, that's a difficult question, but wouldn't it be great if for prosthetic wearing amputees that it was not a have and have not world for prosthetic componentry? And it is, unfortunately. If you don't have insurance, WSIB, lose a limb to cancer or vascular disease, there isn't the same support that others have, and which means you can't, well, depending on your financial situation, but in most cases, you can't access the best technology. And the best technology, talking, let's say, the microprocessor knees, the bionic knees, as people call them, the studies, research has showed they are remarkably more safe and in terms of preventing falls, and they do save the healthcare industry money, but those two dots just we have a hard time connecting them. So if they got connected and everyone had equitable access to the componentry that they need, that would be the story I would love to hang my hat on.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Pleasure, Cam. Thank you.
My pleasure.
In this segment of our show, Sean Wiltshire will be giving us an update on disabilities employment. So with all the potential changes to government coming, how do you think it'll affect disabilities employment?
Well, I think the main point that we have to concentrate on is that from an economic perspective, we need inclusionary practices to make sure that we have a workforce that can respond to things that are going to go on in the economy. I think that one of the challenges we have, Cam, is the idea that we could do this without DEI, without changes. We are looking at a fairly significant trade issue with our biggest trading partner that will trickle down to the local economies of Canada. But we have to remind folks that there is still going to be business to be done. There are still going to be opportunities for businesses to find new consumers. But it's not going to happen if we don't have a diverse workforce. We do the work that's being asked. And we don't. And I know a lot of people will say, oh, well, there's certain industries that that's from. But we're starting to see in different areas. Yes, it's a different story in rural parts of Canada than it is in urban parts of Canada. But we have to balance our response. We cannot be all one thing. Can't be all city. Can't be all rural. That's why the answer has to be more individualized. Because businesses are looking for good employees. Folks with disabilities have skills and are good employees. It's how to match them and let the employer understand how it works. Because with new concepts, employers are busy keeping their businesses going. They don't always have time to understand what the nuances of diversity and inclusion are. And that's why organizations and programs like this are important. We continue to share not only the idea, but the concept behind it. This isn't only about having somebody get a job. This is about solving problems with new ideas that come from people who have different experiences. That's what businesses want, innovative thinkers.
So you raise an interesting point about new ideas there. Do you think employers and even new employees going through training for a particular job are always aware of the options for accommodation and accessibility might be open to them?
No, I think because we train folks throughout their whole life not to make waves, not to ask for assistance. Being asking for assistance is looked at as a sign of weakness. What really we should be looking at is the opportunity to improve process. So if a business has a process that's not being completed because one of the workers is not able to complete the task based on the environment, well, the employer would be well served to fix the issue, to improve the processes, to increase profitability. If not, they have to get rid of somebody, hire somebody, train them again, and probably end up with a different process-related problem. So this is getting businesses to understand that very often they have the solution. It's how you support them to implement it. And giving them the understanding that, you know, you don't have to hire a person and keep them forever. You hire good employees. If it's not working out, you get another employee.
So, are there any steps people can take to better educate themselves as to how to get around these myths? People don't want to make waves, that's true, but there's a right way to get what you need to succeed in the workforce, I think.
Absolutely, and I think that the way folks should concentrate on it is that I'm very productive, but I have some challenges with this process because of an issue that has nothing to do with my ability to do the job. And I think focusing on their ability to do the work and their barrier being something that's in the environment, whether that be a computer, whether that be a staircase, whether that be a, you know, non-productive manager that doesn't feel that, you know, inclusionary practices are important. You know, you're right, Cam. It's how you do it. Raising the issue as one of profitability is a good way to do it. It's always referencing back to the idea that I can do the job, but I'm not doing it as well as I could if I had this piece of support. So it's that increased profitability that we should always refer to. Because it's like saying to somebody, build a set of stairs, but the stairs don't go anywhere. So it's giving somebody the idea that what you have to say is important and what you do increases the profitability of the business. So if we give people the tools that they need, problems will be solved, innovations will be made, and money, which is what the business is there for, will be made. It's important that we remember for many of these employers, this business is their whole life. It's their dream. It's what they've worked day and night for, what they've sacrificed for, what they probably lost marriages for. But the idea that they could have a business was their idea that they had a dream. What we're trying to tell the business owner is, we support your dream. We support the profitability of your business. Let us show you how being inclusive will make your business more profitable. And we've done that for thousands of Canadians across the country through networks, through ideas that people with skills shouldn't be sitting at home wasting those skills. We should have them in the workforce, and goodness knows we need them now, more than ever.
So do you think that once an inclusionary practice is put in place, it kind of sets that precedent. An employee going to an employer saying, this company has succeeded by doing this, and their employment satisfaction and productivity are up, might be a way of actually getting their attention, using the precedent as an example.
It is. And many businesses want evidence that this has worked. And we have, you know, we have several studies, whether it be the U.S. or Canada, that reference the concept that inclusionary practices build better businesses. You engage consumers in a different way. You engage new consumers, which is what every business wants. And consumers are identifying that they wish to shop at companies that reflect the community they live in. And if your community reflects a multitude of diversity, whether it be in ability or in color or religion, well, then the businesses need to understand customers aren't going to come to your business if you're exclusionary. If you only serve one particular community and you're not open to the other consumers, well, then you're missing out as a business owner. You're missing out on those new consumers who may take your product places you never expected. But we can't do that if we don't have businesses that are saying, I'll be inclusive, or this is what inclusive built for me. It's the understanding that if we give people the opportunity to shine, very often they'll shine. But it's also the profitability that the business gains. Businesses want... businesses are there to make money. They're not there to employ people. So when you realize that, we're able to say, well, this individual, even though they have autism, even though they have another disability, they're going to solve this problem for you. We're going to be able to fix that supply chain issue. We're going to have the staffing, but it may look a little different than it did historically. But Cam, as we've said many times before on your show, this is about evolution. It's about getting better. Do the best you can until you know better, then do better.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
Thanks. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
The Sexual Wellness and Consent Committee wants to teach you how to be an ally. Listen, be open to learning from the experience of others. Believe, support survivors and those affected by violence. Speak out, add your voice to call out violence. Intervene, find a safe way to help when you see acts of gender-based violence. Act, give your time to organizations working to end violence and be the change you want to see. A message from the Sexual Wellness and Consent Committee at the University of Windsor.
Welcome back to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Jeff Thiessen gave us an update on Thrive magazine, and we heard a little bit about disabilities employment from Sean Wiltshire. In this segment of our show, Jim Gottstein will be telling us a little bit about his advocacy efforts. So, can you give me an overview of your latest advocacy efforts?
My latest advocacy efforts are the PAMI Advisory Council Empowerment Project. And it turns out, well, let me back up a little bit. So I'm with the Law Project for Psychiatric Rights, Psych Rights, and our mission is to mount a strategic litigation campaign against forced psychiatric drugging and electroshock. And there is a federal law, the Protection and Advocacy for Individuals with Mental Illness, referred to as PAMI, that funds an army of lawyers to ensure that the rights of individuals with mental illness are protected. And it turns out that no more than 10% of the people that get psychiatrically imprisoned, euphemistically called involuntary commitment, or drugged or electroshocked against their will, well, no more than 10% of people who are psychiatrically imprisoned actually meet the legal requirements for being locked up. And no one can constitutionally really be drugged or electroshocked against their will because it has to be proven that it's in the person's best interest and there's no less intrusive alternative, neither of which is ever true. It's so, but there are literally a million people a year that get locked up, and more than that, who get drugged against their will. And it's this massive rights violation. And it's very harmful. These drugs reduce the recovery rate from a potential of 80% to 5%, which seems insane, and reduce lifespans by an average of 20 to 25 years. And all this in the face of people's rights being violated. And the PAMI Act, as I mentioned, it was enacted to ensure that the rights of individuals with mental illness are protected and funds this army of lawyers. And there's this advisory council that's supposed to jointly determine the priorities and policies of each individual state. That's done through what's called a protection advocacy or P&A agency to enforce people's rights. And they've basically been suppressed by the P&As. And so I'm with Christina KK Cap. We've initiated this PAMI Advisory Council Empowerment Project to get the PAMI advisory councils to insist that enforcing people's rights not to be locked up or drugged and electroshocked against their will is a high priority of their protection and advocacy agency. So we're trying to recruit, you know, there are some people that are on the councils already, and we're helping them to try and get this to be a priority, and we're encouraging like-minded people to apply for membership on these councils.
So, I'm curious, how does the council find out about individual cases of people being abused in this way within a mental health care facility?
So, oftentimes people call, and the calls really go to the Protection Advocacy Agency, and they kind of have this gatekeeping thing. But the councils often actually, they do outreach. And the P&As are supposed to, every year, obtain views from the community about what's going on with the mental health system and, you know, and these sorts of abuses and rights violations.
So, I'm curious, what would the ideal outcome be if you could have things changed for the better? What would be the best case scenario to support those who are undergoing mental health treatment?
So, I wrote with a couple luminaries, Dr. Peter Gertje and David Cohen, both really highly regarded international experts. This report and a couple other people, Chuck Ruby and Faith Myers, this report on improving mental health outcomes. And it, you know, it went through this whole thing about how harmful and counterproductive the drugs were. But it also outlines these approaches that really work without all the harm. And so the one that I think is kind of the most comprehensive is called the open dialogue approach, which came out of part of Finland. And they basically have these two-person teams, and they respond to a call within 24 hours, and they work not only with the person, but all the meaningful people in that person's lives. And they don't consider that the problem resides in the person, but in the situation, in the relationships, or maybe the spaces between people. And they've been so successful that they've virtually eliminated the diagnosis of schizophrenia in that part of Finland, because you have to have those symptoms for 6 months to get that diagnosis, and they get people through it. And there are other approaches. There's the Soteria House model, which is basically more of a home-like environment. The expectation is people will get better. They really avoid the use of neuroleptics. This is true in open dialogue, too. They avoid the use of neuroleptics as much as possible. Neuroleptics are usually called antipsychotics, even though they don't have antipsychotic properties for most people. That's really a marketing term, and neuroleptic means seize the brain, which is basically what it does. It just disables people so they can't cause trouble anymore. And both Soteria and the open dialogue approach basically got 80% recovery rates, and that's where I get the 80%. And there are other approaches for short-term crises. There's peer respites. And the report on improving mental health outcomes has a number of other approaches that have been really successful. Another one is, which doesn't really cost money, is the Hearing Voices Network, which, you know, it's what it sounds like. People get together who are hearing voices and talk about strategies to deal with it. It turns out that a pretty high percent of people hear voices, but it's the only the ones where the voices cause them problems in living that gets cleaned up by psychiatry.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
You bet.
Thanks. Jim is also the author of the book, The Zyprexa Papers. Really admire Jim's efforts to promote mental health rights, for the fact is, even in disability circles, things like institutions and the horror stories coming out of them can be something that we shy away from. The truth is, we must not be afraid to look at the realities of any sort of disability life in order to make change. Fact is, there have been a lot of things with institutions in recent memory that honestly need addressing. Fact is, we have to do better by those affected with mental health concerns. We shouldn't be sending them off to the side and then simply forgetting about them. It's not our place to say, we're uncomfortable with this, so we're not going to look upon it. How can someone be expected to function in society if they're not allowed to understand what society really is or what it means? Truth is, there are some people doing good work out there, but there are also those who really should take a nice long look at the way they treat those with mental health conditions. Ask the question, is this really the best we can do? Put them in restraints and forget about them. Look away when things get tough. Or should we be there for them? Be a voice of support. Be a friend. Maybe even be family to those who may have been forgotten by society. Truth is, people are coming to understand more and more that mental health concerns are real. These are not made-up conditions, that these are not just an excuse to veer away from society. This is something that honestly and legitimately affects a person. And if that is the case, and it is something that we, as a people, have a responsibility, an obligation, take a look at and ask, how can we do better for these individuals? This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you, we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.